whatever that is, you know, when I start seeing or feeling, to know that I don't like that part of me, then I don't have to be that way anymore. It's just like at my first meeting, y'all told me that I didn't have to use anymore. And I was sick and tired enough for that to be true. You know, I didn't use anymore. The same way with my fears, the other character defects, and my willingness and ability to put my trust in this power greater than myself. When I really don't want to be that way anymore, I don't have to be. I was so unspiritual, I guess, and resistant to it when I was new, that I clearly remember saying at one time that I knew I'd had a spiritual awakening because when I got to step 12, it told me I had. And what I know now is that I had a spiritual awakening the second day I was clean, because I woke up and I didn't want to use, and I didn't even recognize it at the time. Sometime in my first few weeks, I had probably one of the most important spiritual awakenings I've ever had, is that suddenly I saw that drugs were the problem, not the solution. And I didn't even recognize it. Whatever my most recent one was, I probably didn't recognize it either. Sometimes I get like news flashes, you know, or something's real dramatic. But a lot of the time, it's only with hindsight that I realize what's been done for me. I struggled a lot with the word spiritual. I didn't understand it. I would ask questions. I asked this one person whose recovery I really respected, and they said, well, why don't you grow up, get a job, pay your bills, and mind your own business? I thought they hadn't understood the question. And today I know they understood the question just fine. I just didn't understand the answer, or didn't want to. Finally, somebody told me that a spiritual awakening was a change in attitude, that I could get some kind of a handle on. That's when I could see that my attitude toward drugs had changed 180 degrees. You know? All the other changes are in process. I'm not sure there's one I'd want to claim that same 180 turn for on any other area. How I monitor that puts me back with how I deal with the people that cross my path today. For me, it really doesn't have a lot to do with my relationship with the loving God, higher power. That relationship was totally on 100% all my life. It was on in the depths of my addiction because it's the only way I lived to get here. And I don't have the power to alter that. It's the ultimate arrogance for me to think that my power to offend is greater than God's power to forgive. So I try to stay out of that one. But I can check that on just how I deal with people. That's my barometer for what kind of shape I'm in, how awake I am spiritually. I was given this prayer that really helps me a lot. It's a lot like that little farm boy joke on step 10. And it goes, God, treat me tomorrow the way I treat other people today. Somebody gave me that prayer, and it was probably a week before I actually started to say it. And I recognized that I was afraid to say it. So it showed me that somewhere I had climbed into some kind of idea of a God that was going to punish me, which is not what I wanted. This being Narcotics Anonymous was the freedom for me to change that understanding whenever it needs to change. I changed that one fast when I realized that that's what was making me hesitant about saying that. Once I started saying that, which is some years back, It made me pay more attention to how I treat other people today. I think that spiritual awakening is like a never-ending process. And for me, it's linked with figuring out that my task here was to become human, which I didn't know for a long time. I was a real slow learner about some things. I thought for, easy the first 10 years, that if I worked this stuff really hard, that the program of Narcotics Anonymous would take me to this exalted plane where nothing would bother me. That's what drugs did when I was lucky. And that is not what recovery's done. But I really thought that was where I was supposed to be able to get to. Yeah. And finally, it dawned on me, and I had help, that my task here was to become human. And even more than that, to let you see that, which is probably the harder of the two. I learned that because on those occasions when I would be in these rooms and be human, because it was in so much pain I didn't have a choice to be any other way, that people responded to that. And often when I thought I was being, you know, profound or had the word on recovery, people were intimidated, you know, and put off, which was not what I wanted. Yeah. And I had to take a look at that, because I remember this woman when I first got clean, that going into a room where Carol was like standing next to a warm stove. It just made you feel good. And how much that had meant to me when I was new. And how that was one of the people who had something that I wanted. So how did I get to this big double-digit recovery and find out that that was not what I had? And a lot of the answer was in me thinking that if I worked it really hard and was really rigorous, I was going to get to some kind of recovery perfection, you know, or not feeling stuff, or being calm and spiritual no matter what happened, you know. And it's just one more time. I had it backwards. And I learned that through a series of events that, you know, I had no choice but to be honest about them. And finding out one more time that I'm instructed to be honest around here because it works. And that what I would talk about, the stuff that I wasn't willing to talk about, that's when I had a message to carry. A good example was when I put my son on the plane to go back and see his dad. For a long time, I'd be talking to him in a dance about, you're going to go fishing, you're going to go camping, trying to get him excited about where he was heading. Big smiley thing at the airport. He'd be all happy jumping on the plane, and I would be destroyed driving home from the airport. And one year, it didn't work. And he was real unhappy and had a few little tears. And you know, when I went home from the airport that day, I was just fine. Because the truth was, when something I love goes away from me, I think it ought to wither and die. And if this little kid loved me so damn much, why is he so happy when he's leaving? But all my stuff about who Mom was supposed to be made that not okay. But when I gave that up in a meeting, that's who I really was about that stuff, all kinds of people said, me too. Either they were glad to hear it, or, yeah, they knew that about them, and welcome to the club. Those are the secrets that keep me sick. Not the stupid stuff we all did, and I certainly did when I was using. My secrets aren't any more interesting than anybody else's about that nonsense. That stuff that I believe makes me a monster. And in fact, makes me a human being, trying to get better. Those secrets are what keeps me sick. my unwillingness to share those secrets. You know? When my mother was dying, to talk about the times when I would sit there across from her and would be fussing, and my head would go, "Old lady, why don't you die and leave me your money and make my life better?" That I could say that and understand that I didn't have to take action on it, that it passed, but just that I could admit that. That's where I started to get that kind of freedom. That's where I think I started to really get some awakening of the spirit and become more of a human being, when I stopped trying to be some kind of recovery poster child. You know? My job is to get transparent. And the better I do with that, the more willing I am to do that, even when it's scary and my head still says, "If I tell you the truth about this one, you're never going to want to have anything to do with me," because it still does. You know? That's when I show what's been done for me as a result of these steps, that I can tell you that's who I am. And I can stay clean anyway, and I can be better tomorrow. The thing about, you know, carrying the message, I try to keep it to my experience, strength, and hope. I try to stay out of theory. If I get into theory of what I heard somebody else tried, I haven't done it yet, but it sounds good, then I don't have sponsees, I have guinea pigs, which I don't think they'd appreciate. So I don't ask them to write it unless I wrote it. I didn't give anybody when it was new, the 12-step, the 4-step guide until I'd written the 4-step out of it. You know, I just try to really carefully limit myself to what I have done and what I've learned as a result of what I have done. I think the other thing I try to do about carrying the message is I take personal responsibility. That in California, you have to hold your hand up for the first 30 days. You don't have to, you're asked to. That somebody, if I don't see somebody else doing it, then it must be me, talks to that woman that had her hand up. That I write my number down. And that I try not to share all my experience, strength, and hope. Obviously, I have a tendency to talk a lot. So I try to remember with newcomers, you know, that what I remember is the smiles. What I remember is the hugs and handshakes. And just to keep coming back, you know, "You don't have to use me anymore. We're glad you're here." I don't remember anything profound. The only thing I remember from my first meeting is that we're under no surveillance at any time. That's it. The hardest place for me to practice the principles is at home. The more I care about someone, the tougher time I have in understanding the principle. The more my ego's involved, the more my emotions are involved. My son being the worst for me to try to practice the principles with. Till sometimes it's 5 minutes at a time. This child is 20 now. It's God's own joke. It's like arguing with myself. And he has been a pot smoking beer drinker since he was 15. And that's been a real process for me to back up off that. To try to not do to him, because he's my baby boy, everything that I know does not work. You know, I want to do it anyway. I'm his mother. What can I tell you, you know? To get up off it. And finally, probably within the last year, you know, I've been able to recognize the gift that he tells me the truth about it, you know, and decide that that's more important, that he tells me he's a pot-smoking beer drinker, yeah, than the fact that he is one. He's a high school dropout. And I struggled with that one. And finally, I got a really wonderful suggestion. I told him I thought he needed to retire and be retired for a while. That was in January. He's started college last week, but it's all his idea. He told me that once he got all that THC out of his head, it was amazing how much better he did with his studies, and that they were kind of interesting. And I managed to keep my mouth shut. Total gift of a loving God, I managed to keep my mouth shut about, you know, wailing on him for 4 years. Because I don't think it's the 4 years of wailing on him that did it. I think it's the slightly less than 1 year of not wailing on him, you know. He didn't need me for drug education. He's a kid in the American public school system. That, not to mention the street and his buddies, he's got more drug education than I do. And he thinks this is all his idea. And I kept my mouth shut on that one, too. I don't know where he got so stubborn. I think it must have been from his father's side of the family. But, you know, this was all his doing. Yeah. And it just shows me one more time, another lesson I seem to have to learn endlessly, that the best way I can practice these principles in all my affairs is to get over the idea that I've got a hand to play. Yeah. And I think particularly with this child, to constantly remind myself that he has a higher power working in his life too, and I'm not it. That they don't get issued at 16 like driver's license or 21 like voting permits, you know. But that's always been on there. And that if I would get out of the way, maybe you'd have an even better chance to work. Yeah. I think that I'm through. So thank you all for listening so patiently. Thanks again for committing to asking me to share.